Welcome to the Minder Podcast.
Welcome to episode 18 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I'm your host, Paul Stenning. In this episode, we're going to feature a 2008 interview with George Cole. The reason why I selected this interview in particular is because, first of all, it's a very good interview covering George's life and career in general, but also he particularly talks quite in depth about Minder, which was not something he did very often. Even the extras on the Minder DVDs, for instance, are not particularly detailed. So along with the clips that are interspersed here, I think you'll find this a very worthy programme to listen to, and you'll find out plenty about George Cole and, of course, Arthur Daly. This is the last show of this year for the podcast. We will return in the new year. I'm doing some travelling and have various personal commitments. But in the new year, we will be back with a few interesting ideas for shows, as well as hopefully some brand new interviews. So please come back in the new year and look for episode 19. In the meantime, it's over to George Cole. The interview was recorded, as I said, in 2008, and it was with Mark Lawson of the BBC. Thanks for listening and see you in the new year. Cheers.
Most child actors are in rehab or retirement by the time they're teenagers. But George Cole, though he first appeared on stage in 1939 at the age of 14, is still one of the leading members of his profession 68 years later. His most profitable roles have been as men desperate to make a profit. First Flash Harry in the St. Trinian's films, and then a latter-day black marketeer, the car salesman Arthur Daly, who became an emblem of the Thatcherite 80s in the long-running ITV series Minder. But Cole has remained consistently busy, recently appearing in a number of TV plays about modern Britain by the writer Tony Grounds, including Bodily Harm, A Class Apart, and The Dinner Party. He's one of the very few performers whose careers have stretched from the era of music hall to the age of DVDs.
One of the things that has changed a lot in your lifetime for actors is that DVD means that you can watch your own work if you want to. There are box sets of Minder, St. Trinian's and so on. Do you ever sit down and watch it?
Always. Particularly when they're repeated on television, but now I've got all the DVDs. But, no, I love it.
It's interesting, because some actors, as you know, can't bear to watch themselves
back. I don't understand that. I mean, how do you learn about what you're doing, whether you're doing it right or wrong, if you don't watch?
So even now, you'll catch yourself doing something and think, I could have done that better, or...?
Very rarely. No, but you do catch yourself, I think, you know, talking earlier, but not listening. You think, no, you should be listening a bit more earnestly than you were. But generally, no, I don't think I could improve very much on, certainly not on Minder.
I read that you'd read a book by the American actor Alan Alda called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, and he has a whole chapter on the importance of actors listening to
yes.
other actors, which seems obvious, but actually a lot of actors don't do it.
No, they don't. I mean, some young actors think it's a matter of learning the lines, and if you've learned the lines, you're there. You're not. You know, you can say your lines, but if you're not listening to what the other person says, you're not replying. You're just saying the lines. Now, I found that fascinating, that chapter.
The worst part of being an actor, it seems to me as an outsider, is even someone as successful as you, and you've been pretty much in work for 68 years now, even that you're dependent on somebody giving you a job, the script coming through the door. Do you get used to that insecurity?
Yes, you do. Because you don't believe it. No, I think the only time you worry is if you do have a long period out of work and nothing's come in. But I haven't had any of those.
Now, I was amazed, looking at the list of your credits, pretty much every year in the 68 years, there's at least one thing, sometimes several things.
Yes, true.
So you've never had periods of worry or fear about what was coming next?
I had one period of 11 months, followed by, I think, 4 days in Gone to Earth, a Michael Powell film. But after that, that was the worst I ever had. And I think because it never occurred to me to take another job, so I wasn't worried. And I got through it anyway.
And you've just done a television role with Donald Sinden, who is 84, 2 years older than you. Actors tend not to retire, they just keep going. Do you welcome that, or have you ever felt you'd like to be in a profession where they give you a leaving party and send you off to put your feet up?
No. No, I don't want to stop. I mean, I'm still enjoying every second of it. And I've been doing some very nice scripts by Tony Grounds, particularly.
The Dinner Party?
The Dinner Party.
Please tell me you didn't go out in your vest.
I didn't go out in my vest.
You've got chicken nuggets and chips.
I'm 83. I'll make myself a bit of toast.
Please don't, George.
Would you like a drink, Dad?
No. He's going upstairs, aren't you, George?
I'm all right, son.
I know you are, mate.
It is quite a physically demanding job, learning the lines for a start, the retakes, the locations. Does that ever feel too much?
Well, I think if it was going to feel too much, it would have been so in Minder, because we shot 10 days per episode. Both Dennis and I were usually in most of the scenes, but it was such fun. I mean, when we started, we had an old Green Line bus, which was makeup, hairdressing, wardrobe, and places where Dennis could play cards with his mates. After the second series, we said, no, we don't want that anymore. We want a Winnebago. So very kindly, they gave us both a Winnebago. Well, that lasted for about a fortnight, because we got so fed up with going backwards and forwards to each other, saying, what do you think about this and what do you think about that? So in the end, we said, could we have a big Winnebago? And he can have the front and I'll have the back. And that's how we ended up. And that was wonderful. And he's heaven to work with. I mean, I've just done a new tricks with him and his new gang. And they are a lovely lot to work with.
I let you have them for practically nothing then, didn't I?
Yeah, because you knew they were nicked and I didn't.
And how much did you knock them out to him for then, eh?
Oh, that is immaterial, Terence.
I don't think so. How much? You don't want me to get moody, do you?
Well, as a matter of fact, 1,500.
15? But that doesn't alter the fact that the man refuses point blank to sell them back to me.
Well, we've got to think of something else.
Well, come on, what?
God knows.
Yeah, what about his missus?
Well, what about her?
Well, you mentioned the fact that she didn't like the chairs.
Yeah.
So how about if Terry tries to get into her?
Do what?
Get into... You are talking about a woman whose husband I do business with.
What's that got to do with it? With Terry's natural talent for chatting up the ladies, he could go over there.
What are you talking about? What am I, some kind of bleeding gigolo or something? There's this bird who I've never even seen. I'm supposed to give her a good seeing to, then say for the use of my body, I claim 2 grand's worth of antique chairs.
Well?
What are you, radio rental?
Yeah, it's very distasteful indeed, Terry. In spite of the fact that she is a very attractive lady, who I'm sure would not be averse to a bit of rough trade.
I'll tell you what, why don't you give her one then,
I said
eh?
Rough.
Yeah, if you've got a memory.
I don't think I could.
Oh,
I
don't start all this again. Listen, I think I've got an idea how we're going to get those chairs back without any of us putting our faces on offer.
Well, come on.
Bill and Ben, the corner men.
The what?
A couple of pals of mine, dynamite con artists. They'll want a nice drink, mine.
We'll talk more about Minder later, but I just wondered because as people get older, I mean, most people pass the age of about 40, they start to worry about memory and all of that. But lines and all the rest of it, that has never been a problem for you.
No, because I, when I was doing Minder, I always tape the whole script, doing everybody's lines, but doing mine stronger than theirs. And then I have that tape in the car, and going to work on the Monday, I play the stuff I know I'm going to do today. And then going home, I play the stuff I know I'm going to do tomorrow, which means you don't get home dog-tired and then have to sit down learning lines.
That's fascinating. And so somewhere there are tapes of you playing all the parts in every script you've ever done.
I don't think they are. I think I've taped over all of them. Because occasionally you're trying to learn and something else comes through that you did in between. I mean, he's got the wrong script on there. But, no, I find that works marvellously.
And I talked about the length of your career. If we go back to childhood, born in London in the mid-1920s, your accent is interesting because in your roles you've used a lot of Cockney and a lot of London accents. It's not your natural speaking voice. How would you have sounded when you were growing up?
When I met Alistair Simony's wife, I would talk like that all the time. And I would understand what word I said. And I used to start telling them a funny story. And when I got to the punchline, they'd do that. And I said, what are you doing that for? And they said, we can't stand your vowel sounds. Do something about them. And I think it was a case of do something about your vowel sounds or get out. So I did something about my vowel sounds. But thank goodness I didn't lose the Cockney altogether. It became very useful.
I was going to say, it made you a lot of money later on, with you? Before you met Alistair Sim, which we'll talk about in a moment, but in childhood, so what, your mother and father, what are your memories of them, what were they like?
Oh, they were wonderful. They were lovely. Particularly as I was adopted by them. No, they were marvellous. Except, when I went away on the first job, which was White Horse Inn, and I sent my parents a telegram saying, gone on stage, we'll write. 9 words for 6 months in those days. And I was about that size, with pretty dark curly hair. And people said, years later, what wonderful parents you must have had. Excuse me. And I thought, I don't know about that. Why didn't they come after me or go to the police or something? But no, I didn't see them for 6 months. But, no, they were wonderful in that they allowed it to happen.
How old were you when you found out you were adopted?
13.
It's traumatic for some people, but what was it for you?
No, it wasn't. It was interesting. And, I mean, the problem was to be guilty because I found a letter on top of the wardrobe when I was looking for Christmas presents. And I said, what's all this about? And my mother didn't hesitate to tell me, which was very nice. And, I mean, they'd given me a lovely childhood because they adopted me when I was 10 days old. So, no, they were good.
These days, it's easier because of internet and various agencies, but adopted children very often trace their parents. Do you know anything about your natural parents?
No, nothing at all. Because there was no adoption society in 1925. In fact, if I waited another year, there was an adoption society. So I know a bit more about them.
And there was simply no way of tracing them?
No.
You regret that, I assume?
No.
You don't?
No.
You've never been curious?
I was curious in my teens. But I thought suddenly, you know, what am I doing this for? I've got two parents who are very nice and I love very much. I don't want to find out where I come from because environment can change heredity, in my opinion. And I was very happy.
And you started, you were a professional actor very young, which we'll talk about in a moment, but what had you done before that? What had made you want to act?
I was in school plays. And also, my mother played the piano and my father played the drums. And we did British Legion concerts. And I did comic songs. I also did comic songs at the end of term's school show and got into trouble with the headmaster for doing When I'm Cleaning Windows.
Ah, which was regarded as quite a saucy song at the time.
Very saucy, yes.
And was it a form of impersonation, or
No, I couldn't impersonate anyone in those days. But luckily, practically everyone else had the same accent as I had, and they understood me.
So how had you chosen that song? It was, you'd heard it?
I'd heard it, I'd learned it, I liked it. And when the school concert came up, I thought, well, I'll do it. So I did.
And apart from the acting, were you a good student at school?
Yes, I was. I was at secondary school, council secondary school. And right the way through, I was in the first three in the class, either first, second or third, mostly second and third, because there was a SWAT. He always came first.
Leaving school at 14, which was, it was allowed at the at that time, but you had to have permission from the school to go.
Yes. When you left school in 1939, at 14, the day you left, which was usually a Friday, you had to go up to the headmaster's study and meet someone from the Board of Trade who said, what do you want to do? And you said, I want to be an apprentice engineer. He'd say, right, you go to this firm on Monday morning and they'll give you a job. Then I come up and said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to go on the stage, I want to be an actor. He said, get to the back of the queue. So I got to the back of the queue, and by the time I got up again, I didn't even get a chance to say anything. I was just handed a card and said, that is a butcher's in Morden. Be there at 8:15 on Monday morning. They want a boy who can ride a cycle as a delivery boy. So I thought, well, I don't like that idea that very much. So after school, I was selling papers around the streets of Morden, and suddenly in the middle of the Star, was an advertisement, small boy wanted for London musical. Apply, Helvetia Club, Gerrard Street, London. So the next morning I went up to London, to Gerrard Street, found the Helvetia Club, thought I was in heaven, it was full of chorus girls. I was asked by the person producing, what do you do for an audition? And I can still hear myself saying, I'll do Friends, Romans, Countrymen by Julius Caesar. And I think they said, sorry, could you say that again? Anyway, I ended up doing that. I didn't get the part, but I got the understudy. And I also had to go across the stage every night with two goats and six pigeons. And when we were on tour, I had to share a dressing room with them as well.
And all those decisions to leave school at 14, to go off and audition for the musical, did you tell your parents about all that or just do it yourself?
Just went. No, I mean, I thought I was going to go and then come back the same day. I didn't realise I was going to have to go on a train to Blackpool, which I had to.
Relaxing? Yeah. That's my boy. I woke up this morning and I said to myself, this is it. Erin Dawes had a dream. You won. And she's very hot on the premonition thing, you know. When I had that little Crown Court business, she had a... Oh, my God.
Do you remember Nicky? This is Arthur.
You haven't? Hey, broad daylight, a few hours before a fight.
Nicky's just had a shower.
We were jogging.
Well, that's what they call it nowadays, is it?
Arthur.
You realise what you're doing, don't you? Draining your vital fluids. That's for you, miss. Any more like you, there'd be 4 million on the old King Cole.
This is my day off.
Oh, yeah, handing out your supplementary benefits.
Well, listen, you... Look, I'm sorry, I didn't warn you about him, did I?
And I don't like his innuendo.
Well, calm yourself up for a start. I'm as liberal as the next man.
No, you're not.
Well, I walk into a well-known bird bandit's lair.
Shut up!
Find some Comely Richard flaunting her Harris round a gaff.
We were just about to have some tea.
Tea? You're supposed to be having a medical check.
All right, no sweat.
No sweat? I'm the one who's sweating.
But your parents were happy for you to leave school?
Yes, yeah.
What would they have wanted you to do?
Well, they'd probably been quite happy if I'd taken the job at the butcher's in Morden, because it would be another wage coming in. But, no, I didn't want to do that. And in fact, I think I got 28 and 6 a week, and £1 paid for my digs, and I sent home a 5 shilling postal order, which always came back in the form of a box with a cake and sweets and God knows what all in it. And they seemed quite happy, and I was quite happy. Anyway, I got there and went on tour. then came into the London Coliseum. And one day, our chaperone, who was the boy I was understudying, his mother was our chaperone, and she said, Charles is going for an audition at the Strand Theatre on, whenever it was. Would you like to come along and watch? Because there might be one or two famous people there. And I said, well, yeah, I'd like to do that. So I went along at Strand. There was no scenery, it was bare stage, and the director, Richard Bird, was down in the stalls, and there were these boys on the edge of the stage. So I hung back by the exit door, not wanting to get in the way. And suddenly, Richard Bird started yelling at me, don't waste my time, come on, come on. And I said, oh, I'm just watching. So, no, come on, come on, come on. Thrust the script in my hand, said, read that. I read it. It was a Cockney evacuee. I got the part. And then he said, you have to go to Oxford today. So I thought, well, I said, okay, fine, I'll go to Oxford, I've got some money.
And this was a play called Cottage to Let.
Yes.
A wartime, a thriller.
The very first spy thriller of the war, yeah. It never occurred to me to say to the people at the Coliseum, I won't be coming in this afternoon. So I don't know who dealt with the goats and the
pigs. So there's a dressing room full of animals.
Yes. And I got to Oxford. I think it was a Sunday. And quite late. And I was very small and carrying my big suitcase around with me. And, of course, I hadn't had to worry about digs until now. Suddenly, I got to find digs for myself. I got no chaperone. So I went everywhere. I went to the police station. No one could help me. So I went to the theatre and found the stage director. And I was on the verge of tears. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, I've got can't get no digs. I don't know where to live. And at that moment, this rather handsome young man came in and said, what's the matter with him? And Jerry Clifton, the stage director, said he can't find digs. So this young man, who was playing the juvenile lead, said, well, you go and find him some digs, and I'll take him over to the Welsh Pony and give him something to eat. So he took me over to the Welsh Pony, and this was, you know, rationing time, ordered two mixed grills, tipped them onto one plate, said, get that inside you, and went back to the theatre. Now, on the Monday, we start rehearsing, and the young man who was playing the juvenile lead didn't appear. And apparently he'd been called up. So I never saw him. Well, roll forward 30 years. I'm sitting in the MGM studios in Elstree. And a very handsome young man comes over and says, is that the young boy I gave two mixed grills to? And I said, yes. It was Stuart Granger.
And what did you say to him?
I said, I didn't know what to say. I mean, how he recognised me, I don't know, because I'd taken over from an actor who died, and I was wearing a very grey wig. But someone must have told him.
And it's quite unusual now, but there was a much closer link then between stage plays and films. Successful plays were filmed quite quickly, and that began your film career in 1941, Cottage to Let.
Yeah.
And the real significance of that is that's where you met your great mentor, Alistair Sim.
Yes, yeah. And in fact, I met him in the play, and the Blitz started, and Alice's wife was pregnant, and so they used to live in Hampstead, and they moved out to the country. Alice was worried about the fact that I was living in London with my mother, and he said, you've got to get out of London and get somewhere in the country, so we're going to evacuate you and your mother, which they did, very kindly, to a place in the country. It was very odd, because the Blitz settled down. Everything had closed, and it settled down, and everything opened again. My mother couldn't stand the quiet of the country. She'd rather have the bombs. So she went back to London. And we took the play, Cottage to Let, round all the army camps. And by this time, there was a very odd atmosphere about the Blitz, because people wanted in. So we went back into Wyndham's. Having run there for 9 months, we now went back in again, and ran, I think, for another 9 months. And that's when I met Alistair and Naomi, and got the film. And there was a press story about how they'd adopted me, which I found rather odd, because I was already adopted. You can't adopt twice. And my story, which is the right one, is that I adopted them, and 50 years later, they spent the next 50 years trying to get rid of me. which was rather difficult because I built my house next to theirs in the country. So it was wonderful.
But did you ever know, what was it, he saw something in you as an actor, or what was it that he took you under his wing in that way so early on?
I think one of the things was both of them, Naomi as well, that they felt that if I was going to go on being an actor, I got to do something about the Cockney accent, or you're going to be a Cockney actor for the rest of your life. And they had beautifully modulated vowels, being Scots.
And you worked with him a lot, and we'll talk about some of that, but would he give you formal advice? Would he say, this is the way to do it, try this, don't do that?
No. No. He was quite harsh. And he would say things like, he was a wonderful stage director, but he'd be in the stalls, and I'd be on, and everybody else would be on. And he'd suddenly say, Georgie, just move a bit more to the right, a little bit more. That's right, now I can't see you at all. And that's when you began to realise that you've got to start watching and seeing what had to happen. But, no, he was very good. And he worked in a wonderful way, because every play he did, he put his own money in. And he insisted on, he didn't mind rehearsing in a room for 3 weeks, but for the fourth week he wanted a theatre, a stage, the set-up and all the props. So by the end of the fourth week, you'd run the play for a week. It was wonderful.
And you talk about the atmosphere of the Blitz and coming and going. It must have been a strange time because you were in these plays, these musicals, but there was fear, presumably. I mean, you knew that things were likely to get bad.
Yes. It was very odd because when we were at Wyndham's, when the Blitz started, we all went up on the roof to watch. And then we did the film at Shepherd's Bush Studios, Lime Grove, and we slept in the studio. But again, we went up on the roof at night and watched it. Total madness. But it was a great atmosphere then.
And as a young actors often aren't frightened, they don't get stage fright, but were you ever nervous as an actor starting so young?
No, because I was playing a Cockney evacuee who swore, and I was getting paid for it, so there was no fear at all. I think the only time I had a frightening moment was we were playing Cardiff, and towards the end of the play, I think it was in the third act, in the interval, I have to get into a big blanket box on the stage, and at a vital moment, suddenly bang the lid up, jump up, and run off. While I was in the blanket box, they dropped a bomb very close to the New Theatre, Cardiff. And I wondered, should I get out now? But no, like the good boy I was, I stayed there till my cue came, and then I was out and away.
And one of the reasons that you'd had a chaperone was to keep you away from young theatrical ladies. But once you didn't have one, what was that a great opportunity? I mean, were you surrounded by young women?
While I was in Whitehall's Inn, I was surrounded by young women. I mean, prematurely developed little girls of 14. And beautifully developed young ladies who I thought were at least 30, and I found out later were 18. But they were marvellous.
And then, as the war developed, there was a prospect of being called up, presumably.
Yeah. I was called up when I was 18 in the RAF. And I was in for 4 years. just before I was called up, I was given the chance of playing Jim Hawkins in Treasure Island, and I wanted to do that. So, having joined the RAF, or not, I've tried to join the RAF, you then go before a board who say, why do you want to join the RAF? And I said, well, I want to play Jim Hawkins, and I'll get a bit of deferment. Well, you're supposed to say, I want to fight and fly with the RAF. So again, I was told to get out and go to the end of the line. But then I got the Rattigan play, which was Flairpath, and I got the part of Boy in Henry V, and I got a certain amount of deferment for that, so That was the last thing I did.
Because those films were considered part of the war effort.
Oh, definitely Henry V, yes. But I went into the RAF as a boy and came out as a man, having shoveled coal and God knows what all. But it was good for me.
So Henry V, you were directed by Olivier, weren't you?
Yes, yeah. He was wonderful. I mean, look, he plays everyone's part, but never in a way that he wanted you to do it. It was always a way of explaining to you, this is how it could be played. He would take his handkerchief out and put it round his head and be the perfect mistress quickly. And it was wonderful to see the way it all went. And I think I had one line that was a forerunner of Arthur Daly, which was, you'll be famous, boy, you'll be famous. And I remember walking off saying, famous, I'll give all my fame for a pot of ale and safety. And I thought, that's pure young Arthur Daly. Show me a pub.
And I wonder about that during the war, because you went on to play a lot of spivs. There were a lot around during the Second World War. Did you see people who were useful to you later when you played those roles?
Somebody said, another performer had said, that I pinched Flash Harry from him. And I met him some time later. And I said, I understand you think I pinched Flash Harry from you. And he said, no, certainly not. I said, well, you're wrong, because I pinched it from Sid Field. But really, he was a cartoonist created Flash Harry, because the cartoon in the book was him leaning at 45 angles, degree, round a corner, with the moustache and with the hat. So he made it all for you.
And going into the RAF, because perhaps surprisingly, there are people in their 40s, 50s now who've never been sent to war, so you're the last generation that really have that experience. But were you frightened when you were sent?
Well, I don't think I can say I was sent to war, because I trained to be a wireless operator, and I didn't do well with the Morse. I couldn't learn it, because I wasn't being paid enough. And so I became what was known as ACHGD, Aircraft Hand General Duties. So I did my square bashing, then I went to Blackpool, and because I couldn't do the Morse, I had the job cleaning out the winter garden. And then I was on parade one day, and the sergeant said, come out here, Basil Rathbone. And I didn't know who he meant. And then he made it very clear who he meant. And I'd been told I got to come down to Pinewood for an RAF film called Journey Together. So I came down for that. And unlike all the other actors like Dickie Attenborough and Jack Watling, Edward G. Robinson, who all went home in the evening in London, I was made to go back to Coastal Command, where I was shoveling coal, as soon as the day had finished.
So the acting, in fact, saved you from being sent into conflict, probably?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm virtually blind in my left eye, so that didn't help. And I did have trouble trying to learn dot, dot, dash and all that. But I ended up running a bar in Coastal Command headquarters. Then I was posted to Germany, where I was put in charge of another bar. And that's what I did until the end of the war. So I can't say I was in the war.
And then pretty soon after the war, the acting career resumed.
Yes. When I came out, I had a play, Bridie play, with Alistair Sim, Dr. Angelus. And that was successful. And that was very good, because suddenly I was playing an adult. I'd gone into the RAF wearing short trousers and come out a man. So that saved me trying to get over from one to the other.
When did your accent change? When did the Sims...
It had to change for Dr. Angelus, but I think it had changed before then. I'd realised it had got to, and I think I made sure it didn't.
And so you just, consciously, you just did it yourself. You changed the way you spoke.
Yes. Plus the fact that getting insulted all the time by Alistair.
And you did many films with Alistair Sim, but the biggest were, I suppose, Scrooge and then the St. Trinian's films.
Yes, yes. Yes, I mean, Cottage to Let, Scrooge, The Green Man. He was in, I think, two of the St. Trinian's films. He wasn't in all four.
Would he give you advice on film sets? I mean, were you conscious of getting better as an actor?
Yes, yes. You would play a scene. A scene in The Green Man, I remember. And he suddenly said to me, if you're going to do it like that, oh, I'm going to take it. And I thought, what's he mean? And so I thought. And the next time I did it, it was quite different. And he said, good boy. So I got the message.
So what did he mean by take it, take it?
Oh, he'd have to control it. If I was going to be lacking energy, which is what I think he meant, he'd have to do something about it. I got the message, and it ended up being a lovely scene between the two of us, going mad trying to dial 999.
And when you were offered the first St. Trinian's, did you realise straight away that it was a very attractive character to play?
Yes, yeah. I had a theory that Flash Harry was conceived in the bushes in that school and had never been out in the wide, wide world. But no, it was lovely. Really wonderful to play.
And we're giving that money back.
What? You going potty or something?
This way we don't get involved with a conspiracy charge if it comes on top.
I can't do that.
I can, and I can't afford it, so you certainly can.
Look, Terry, the aggravation alone isn't worth what you've got out of it.
I'm not going back to Nick for a poxy 300 quid.
Look, Terry, be reasonable. I mean, even if we get the ball back without any difficulties, them yoicks are not going to start screaming for their money and putting themselves on offer, are they?
I don't care. I'm not taking any chances with my liberty.
But what do you think we're doing now? And what about all that clobber I bought? That's got to be paid for, you know? That is your genuine out-of-pocket expenses, Terry.
As you said yourself, Arthur, let this be a lesson to us all.
Oh, my God, look at this. Nothing but fields, open spaces. Exposure is terrible.
That's funny. Yesterday it was England, my England.
Funny it's not, Terry. We're a dot on the card to be spotted, I'm telling you. Me and my city pinstripe were a wild animal in possession.
Suddenly it's a wild animal, is it?
Who can tell? Snatched from the security of the field, it knows us home. A thing like that could unbalance his brain, turn it into a raging wild beast. Look, let's turn back while we still got the chance.
No!
Listen! Helicopter! They're probably scouring the whole area. We're a million to get that.
Turn it in, will you?
They've all got estates down here, you know.
Who have?
Crown Court Beaks. Descendants of Judge Jeffreys.
Judge who?
Jeffreys. Known as a hanging judge. That sort of excessive attitude to lawbreakers is passed on from generation to generation. That lot think a plea of mitigation is a request to go to the toilet. It'll be the maximum sentence. No mercy. Stand on me.
I will if you don't turn it in.
Oh, my good God. It's on top. I know it. It's on top.
Arthur, we're still in your car. We haven't even got the ball yet. Come on, he's waving you on.
Is he following?
On a push bike.
Don't let that fool you. He could radio ahead, put out on all points. All that politeness is just to lull you into a false sense of security.
It's the first copper we've seen for miles.
Don't let that fool you. They're all around, lurking in the hedgerows, hiding in the hay.
Doodah, doodah. Just drive.
I mean, there was a real British film industry at that stage, but what were you treated grandly as an actor? What was it like?
No, I wasn't treated grandly. Wasn't paid much either. I think the combination of the St. Trinian's films, which were in the 50s, and the radio series A Life of Bliss, which was about the same time, combined to get me recognised.
You were playing a young man called David Alexander Bliss. Barry Took has written in his book about the recordings of that series, which sound quite extraordinary because the writer was rather chaotic and disorganized and tended not to finish the script by the time of the recording.
That's right. It used to start off very well. The BBC would say, right, we want four scripts before we start. So they'd get four scripts, but of course when it came to number five, you'd only written 10 pages. So we had to come in. We were either at the Aeolian Hall or Playhouse Theatre, and go on stage, start the show with an audience, and then suddenly I would be handed up pages, which I hadn't even seen, but I'd had to go and carry on recording. And then we had one very, very bad time when we were all still there at midnight, and he was downstairs writing the script, and the audience had gone, and I used to go down and see how he was getting on, and he was... And then he'd pick up an empty water jug, fill an empty glass with nothing, drink it, say, I must go to the loo. And he'd come back and... there's another page.
Oh. And Barry Tooker says in the book that the writer, Godfrey Harrison, that his wife would be there frantically trying to encourage him to write some more pages.
Yeah. Well, we had one actress, I can't remember her name, who at 11 o'clock said, no, I've got people coming for supper, I'm going, goodbye. Meant what we'd already done had got to be adapted as we went on. But it was a very successful series.
You know, it's time you settled down and had a family, Poppet. We must think of some nice girl for you.
Oh, gosh, don't you start. I've had enough of that with Mrs. Griffin.
Don't worry, I wasn't serious.
No, I know you weren't.
I know who'd be perfect for you. Pauline Massey.
Pauline Massey?
You must have met her, Helen Massey's sister. About 24, awfully pretty. She's the perfect wife for you.
Will I be allowed to see her before I decide?
Yes, of course.
And you did that on television as well, I think.
Yes, I think we only did one series. Because we had the same problem. You know, we were on air in an hour's time and there's still another six pages to come.
And you were doing more and more TV, Man of Our Times as well in the 60s, but you were coming to be regarded as a comic actor. Was that what you'd always wanted to do? Was that how you saw yourself?
No, I saw myself in David Bliss as a light comedy actor. And I saw myself in The Centrinians as a broad comedy actor. And then Julian Bond created A Man of Our Times. And that was a wonderful part in... It was 13 episodes in a real-time scheme. In that, in the first episode, he was going to be made redundant. And this was a year in which redundancy became a word everyone understood, whereas they probably hadn't before. And he was given a month to make up, 3 months to make up his mind, either to take redundancy or go and work in Australia. And it was very timely, because we were dealing with strikes, and we were dealing in the series with strike.
But these labels people use for actors, because often people would describe you as a character actor, whereas in fact all actors play characters, so it's always seemed strange to me. Do they have any meaning for you, those sort of labels?
I think I got my first adult review in a film called My Brother's Keeper, in which I was handcuffed to Jack Warner to escape convicts. And the review in either Picture Show or Picture Goer said, this young man has a name I wouldn't wish on a house painter and a face that makes Bela Lugosi look pretty. It was signed B.F. Now that could have been Brian Forbes. Probably wasn't.
Have you ever asked Brian Forbes?
No.
Were you hurt by that review?
No. I mean, you can't hurt me after that. Because I know I'm not as ugly as Bela Lugosi. And I don't care what house painters think about my name.
Exactly. Amazing snobbery, to pick on a name.
Yes, yeah.
So I suppose, well, what they were trying to say, but in a rather rude way, was that you weren't going to go for romantic leads. So that's what they mean by a character actor, right?
Yes, I think they mean you're not very pretty. Yeah, I think that's what they mean.
The stage acting you kept going, I mean, quite major roles. For example, Christopher Hampton's The Philanthropist, which you did...
For 2 years.
2 years in the 1970s. And that, again, I say, that's the other side of your acting range, because that was you were playing an academic...
Yeah, I think that's one of the best plays that's been written in my lifetime, anyway. And it was a mistake to stay in it for 2 years. But after the first year, Michael Codron put my salary up. Put my salary up if I'd stay for another year, which I did. But it became a nightmare towards the end because I would drive up to London and find myself going into London Airport for no good reason. But I obviously didn't want to go to the theatre. And your concentration was paper thin. I mean, instead of it being stronger the longer you played it, it went the other way. And we were at the Mayfair Theatre. And you had to come out of the theatre through the front of house. There was no stage at all. And I came out one day and some people were looking for something. And I said, what have you lost? And they said, glasses or a lighter or something. So I said, I think you'll find it's four rows further forward, because I'd heard it roll down. But that's the sort of thing that you can't keep it up that long.
Right through your career, it's been important to keep the stage acting going, because some people, once they get film, once they get TV, they think, I don't want to do that anymore. But you've always kept both.
Yes, I'm not so sure that I would like to be in a chance would be a fine thing, be in a long run in London, because it would mean driving 500 miles a week, and that's the bit I don't like. So I'm very happy to do plays at places like Windsor, which is a lovely theatre, and I've done several plays there with my wife. And as far as touring is concerned, I'm quite happy to do the home counties, but I don't want to go much further because I like to get home at night.
And also, in something like The Philanthropist, you got the benefit of what The Sims had done for you, because that was a posh role, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
And so it's been very useful to you as an actor to have both voices, the Cockney and the posh.
Yes, yes. And not to lose the Cockney, because I've needed it. And to get away with the posh.
Well, I suppose the first thing is to choose a foreman.
Yes, that is the usual, normal procedure. Yeah, how about you, my dear? No?
What about you, Arthur? I mean, you seem to have some idea, you know, the way you handle that oaf and it. I mean, why don't you do it?
Oh, I don't know. All right. As a matter of fact, I do have a certain working knowledge of the law.
Yeah, well, no one objects, do they?
No, let's just get on with it, shall we?
Well, what's the procedure? Do we just vote or what?
Just vote?
Well, the man's clearly guilty. You've only got to look at his face.
Madam, with respect, a man's boat is hardly a reasonable foundation on which to base a conviction.
Bloody right.
What is boat? I do not understand.
Boat race, madam. But look, let me just say this. As the duly elected foreman of this jury, I need hardly remind you that it is our sworn duty to weigh the evidence, balance the scales of justice, free ourselves from the constraints of prejudice and blind emotion, and arrive at a true and honest verdict in accordance with the facts. Thank you.
That's very good, isn't it?
Well, that's perfectly true, Mr...
But Daly, Miss Arthur Daly. And you are?
Oh, Miss Carol Dalston, actually.
Oh, well, Carol. Oh, I can call you Carol, can't I?
Oh, yes, if you like.
Oh, I think first name's the best, don't you? It makes it all much cosier.
Yeah, that's right, Arthur, yeah.
Carol?
Well, it just seemed to me that it might be a good idea to start off with a show of hands, to begin with.
I agree. At least we can see how we all stand before we start arguing the pros and cons. Sorry.
No, you were quite right. I was about to make the same suggestion myself. Is everyone in agreement?
Yes.
Very well. All those present here who think
without so much as a discussion, mind you, that the defendant is guilty, raise her right hand.
The Cockney is very important because it was one of the most important roles of your career. Arthur Daly, when you were presumably what, you were sent one script, were you?
No, I wasn't sent a script. I was, what was I doing? Oh, I was doing Brimstone and Treacle.
Dennis Potter play.
Yes.
Oh. It had been banned from TV.
Mm.
A very harsh play.
Yeah. I used to say to my wife as I went off to the theatre, I'm going up to London to spend 2 hours arguing with my wife. It was awful. And so suddenly I got a message. Would I meet Lloyd, George Taylor and Lloyd...
Yeah, God, what's his name? Euston Films.
Yes, anyway, got a message to meet them at a hotel in, I think, Jermyn Street. And I said, oh, I can't, no, I've got to do this play. And then it came back again and said, look, just come and have a drink. So I thought, oh, all right. And I said to my agent, why have I got to meet them? Because I've done armchair theatre for them and all that sort of thing. They know what I can do. They said, well, you go and see them. So on the way to the theatre, I went to see them. And Lloyd Shirley and George Taylor handed me a format.
Yeah.
And said, read that. So I read it. And I couldn't stop laughing. And... he said, well, you want to do a series of that character. How do you feel? I said, what wonderful. I'm quite happy with having read that. And I think it was Lloyd who said, do you think you've got the stamina for it? That was the first episode of 107 episodes, so I must have had the stamina for it. But it was a joy to do.
And so when... there was a first script. When you looked at him, did you get him instantly? Could you see?
Absolutely. When I read the format, it said Arthur Daly is right behind the present Home Secretary as far as Law and Order is concerned. His favourite film is The Godfather, and he dresses like a dodgy member of the Citizen Advice Bureau. And I thought, that's enough for me. I know exactly who that man is. And I didn't get a script until we started.
And you also thought, presumably, I can use that accent that The Sims made me give up.
Yes, yes.
And often in these big television roles, Inspector Morse is an example for John Thor or Del Boy for David Jason, it's important that they're part of a double act, that the other actor has been important in those, Nicholas Lyndhurst or Kevin Wakely. That was certainly true in the case of Minder, wasn't it? That it was crucially a double act.
Absolutely. And it was such fun to do. He's a lovely actor to work with, makes very good suggestions, and he gives as much as he gets, which is good.
So when you first met Dennis, had you worked with him or known him before?
Well, you were sitting in the car in Minder, in the street. I was sitting in the back. He was in the front with a girl. And he started talking about this film he was in, called Fright. And I said, you weren't in that film. I was in that film. He said, you weren't. I said, I was. It turned out that I'd only come into the film after he'd been killed and he was lying face down in the hall and I stepped over him. But apart from that, I did one Sweeney, so didn't know him.
As soon as you met, it worked as a combination.
I think we circled each other for about 3 days and then realised that neither of us were fighting for the billing and that we were both enjoying each other's company.
And did you ever get sick of each other?
No. Because he had the front of the Winnebago and I had the back. And we didn't spend much of our spare time, because only an hour for lunch. He was a great pub person and a great football person, and I'm neither of those things. And if you've spent 26 weeks together, you don't seek out each other necessarily when you're not working. But we go and see each other. I mean, he came to see me in Party Peace at Windsor, and we went to see him in My Fair Lady, which he was absolutely wonderful. And at Party Peace, he came and he said, where are you going next week? I said, we're in Eastbourne. And as he went out the stage door, he said, now you be careful, watch out for those women in Eastbourne, And remember, they're all older than you.
Did you ever fall out on it? Ever have an argument over a scene?
No,
or
no. No, we used to meet in makeup and do all our chatting there and work out that scene, this scene, or whether we liked it or whether we didn't. And also, when somebody new came in, we made sure they came into the Winnebago, and if they had a lot of tricky stuff, worked it through with us, and they were very happy with that. And we had wonderful casts. They were really lovely.
When it started to go out in 1979, presumably quite early on, you got a sense that it was a hit, that it was working.
No. No. First of all, it was delayed because Thames went on strike.
Oh, they were on strike, that's right.
Yeah. So we only did 11, and they went out. And they went out in the Sweeney spot. And we got some reaction, but not very much. But what was interesting, and this was what was so wonderful about Euston Films, before we'd finished the first series, they commissioned a second one.
Which would never happen now, would it?
No, you wouldn't get as a, if you get to number six, probably, and they say you're not getting 15 million viewers, so goodbye. And the next series, we did 13. And we still didn't get in the ratings. But the third series, we suddenly appeared in the ratings, and we went very, very high. And you knew something was happening because taxi drivers would say, "As are indoors." Or others of them would say, "You must pay that boy a bit more money, it's not fair." And you've sensed they caught on to the characters. And from then on, we didn't look back.
When you first did it, what became the catchphrases, "are indoors," "nice little earner," did you realise when you first said them that they were?
No, we just thought they were delightful phrases, but no idea. And I mean, "are indoors" is now in the Oxford Dictionary.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
And so you would get, people would start giving you "and nice little earner," you'd get those phrases back.
Yes, all the time, yeah. And people trying to sell me Japanese Havana cigars.
Did you ever get irritated by that level of attention from people?
No. The one thing I learned very quickly, you can't do window shopping. Otherwise, you'll get buttonholed and told the details of the last six episodes of Minder. So you've got to keep moving. The only time it got worrying is when you're going down the motorway at 60 miles an hour and somebody passes you at 70, winds down the window and says, "Oh, ah!" That's quite worrying, and you quickly pull into the slow lane.
Some actors, once they get involved in a hit, although it's great to be in one, they start worrying about how long to stay in it, and there are actors who have left series for that reason, because they fear typecasting. Did you worry about that, being in it for so long?
No. I mean, you, if you're enjoying it and it's good, you're getting good scripts, don't worry about typecasting. I mean, it's other people and critics worry about typecasting, but as an actor, and certainly at my age, I'm not worried about typecasting. Just give me a job.
But you did mind it for so long, and Dennis Waterman left it, and you went on, and he was replaced. Did it remain as satisfying for you right through?
Yes, it did, but in a different way. Gary Webster was a completely different animal to Dennis, but I enjoyed working with him very much. Thames lost the franchise, that's why it finished. But we came in with Mrs. Thatcher, and we outstayed her by 5 years.
On the Mrs. Thatcher point, I was going to raise that because you probably know, apart from being in the Oxford English Dictionary, quite serious books now about British politics say that Minder, Arthur Daly, was all part of the Thatcherite revolution, and that's why people liked it. Did you ever think about any of that?
I only thought about it after, when people said, "How do you feel about doing some more now?" And you have to say no, it's had its time. It was a time of greed. And he certainly was a greedy man. But people enjoyed that because they'd like to do that and get away with it.
And it's the same as David Jason's Del Boy. I mentioned that they belong to that period very much,
absolutely,
don't they?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
70s,
yeah.
80s, yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned being asked to do more. Have there been attempts to bring it back over the years?
No. No, people have said, "Would you consider doing more?" And I've said no.
You would never?
Well, you must never say that, must you? No.
Can I be of assistance, gentlemen?
You must be Jim. Arthur Daly. And this is Terry.
I'm sorry, have we met?
Well, we have now. I'm a business acquaintance of Alex's. I've just come from seeing him at hospital. Been telling me all about your aggro.
My aggro?
Aggravation problem. And the little firm that's been busy at the demand.
He means the two nasties who've been asking you to contribute to their protection scheme. Oh, I see.
And I am here to set your mind at rest. You have nothing to worry about from this moment on.
Oh?
Yeah, Alex has asked me, in my capacity as professional security advisor, to see that you and the shop are looked after until he can do it himself.
Look after?
Minded, protected. And Terry here is the best.
Is he indeed?
Hold on, Arthur, hold on.
No, you have nothing to worry about with Terry around.
Excuse me one moment, would you please?
Can I have a word with you?
Yeah, what's the matter?
Listen, if you think I'm staying in the same pad with that, you've got another thing coming.
What are you talking about? What's wrong with him?
Leave it out, can't you see?
See? Well, what is there to see? Perfectly charming young man. All right, so he may not be one of the chaps.
Arthur, the geezer is a raving iron.
Don't be ridiculous, an iron.
Oh, you have to scream it.
How do you know he's a poofter? How can you tell?
I can tell, believe me. Go on, have another look. Don't make it too obvious, eh?
He can't be.
Can he? Why not? There are thousands of them about.
Yeah, I know, but I mean...
No wonder you called that mate of yours a man's man.
Leave off. Alex, a poofter. You must be joking. He's a married man with children.
You told me yourself he'd left them and got to live Case with Jolly Jim.
In the same flat, Terry. In the same flat. I did not say that was Case. There's a spare bedroom. He told me so.
Arthur, I don't give a monkey's what your mate's into, right? And I've got nothing against irons. I just don't want to live with one.
Look, you are wrong about Alex. I'll lay odds. And even if you're right about him... I don't see that it makes any difference.
Oh, you don't, eh?
Well, no, I mean, he's not going to try any of that stuff with you, is he?
And if he does?
Well, then you just have to use a bit of diplomacy, won't you? Say you're sorry, but you're normal. Say it'd upset your mum or something like that.
Arthur, it would upset me. I'm likely to give him a right hander, never mind the other firm.
No, 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 don't you do that. I mean, what would I tell Alex? Look, we could be on a right earner here. The man's loaded.
Arthur, what's it going to look like when people hear that I'm living with an iron, eh? It's going to do my reputation a world of bleeding good, innit?
Nobody will hear. How can they? Who knows you on this manor?
I don't care. I don't like it.
Look, Terry, look at it from the positive side. Luxury flat, room of your own, chance to educate your mind to the finer things of life, like antiques. And I mean, it's not as if you have to be a consulting adult.
Arthur,
Look, please, Terry, just for me. I promise I'll see that everything's kosher.
Well, gentlemen, since I've never seen or heard of you before today... You won't mind if I check with Alex about all this, will you?
No, I'll come with you.
Come with me?
To the hospital.
No, that won't be necessary.
Immediately after Minder, did you find that people tended to offer you Arthur Daly type stuff?
You got sent a bit, but not very much. Most times it didn't get past my agent. I mean, she would look at it and tell me, say, shall I send it to you? And she'd give me an idea about it, and I'd say, no, I don't think so. But no, you do, yeah.
You did a Building Society ad in which was a version of Arthur Daly, wasn't it?
No, it was not. when I did that, the ITC, or whoever they are...
The regulator at the
wardens,
time. Yeah.
The wardens, yes. Said, wrote to my agent and said, George Cole is not to do the Leeds commercial because you mustn't do... He was a character that's on ITV at the time. And I sent back a message saying, that is not Arthur Daly. Arthur Daly would be seen dead in that sheepskin coat and that flat cap. And still they didn't like the idea. But in the end, we got a very nice note saying, all right, we accept that the Leeds man is a distant relative of Arthur Daly. So I was allowed to do it.
Well, I started racing greyhounds now, and this one's no beginner. He hasn't lost a single race, a dead cert money spinner. That's why I call a hairy hound.
Did you have to think hard about whether to do adverts? Because that is a decision actors have to make.
Again, it comes down to script. I mean, the first commercial I did was for Hamlet Cigars, and it was one of the best scripts I've ever seen.
That's interesting, because a lot of people cynically think that actors just do adverts for the money and don't take it very seriously. But you took that seriously as a bit of acting.
Yes, because it was a good script. And also the Leeds man. These were very good sketches of this character. And I mean, I think it was early rap, actually. And again, you did two 1-minute ones and a 30-second one once a year. It's a week's work.
And probably a year's money. I mean, astonishing amounts they pay for.
Yes, and you obviously didn't worry about doing things that you didn't want to do.
A television series I have fond memories of, but probably few people remember, is Don't Forget to Write by Charles Wood.
Wonderful.
Which was a tremendous series, and most of the people I know who are writers remember that series very fondly. Mm. That was very, very different from... I'd say it's the other end, it's the posh academic end of your acting, but you were playing a playwright, a reluctant playwright.
Yes. I mean, he got fed up writing, and he would lock himself in his room, make a tape recording of his typing, and then switch on the tape recorder and open the window and go out and do some gardening.
Gordon? Do you want another cup of tea?
And when Gwen Watford, the wife, came and listened at the door, all she heard was tip-tap, 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 so she assumed he was working, till she found out.
More tea.
Turn the typewriter off, would you, please?
First time in 22 years you have ever tried to deceive me.
Nonsense.
Yes?
No, I've tried often.
Why?
Well, some of them are quite pretty.
The stuff that's come in recent years, I mean, you were offered, how do you make that judgment as to what to do? It is the script.
Yes. If by page 5 you get up to make a cup of coffee, you're not going to do it. If you don't get up to make a cup of coffee, it's more likely that you are going to do it. But you can tell at once. I mean, with good writing, you no problem at all. But occasionally you get something that you've seen before and you don't want to do it.
But you're thinking, what can I do with this? What can I do with this role?
Well, before that, you're thinking, does this come off the page? And most times it does. And you don't have any problem. Charles Wood came off the page like nobody's business, and there was no problem at all there. And what was so wonderful was Charles liked writing two people talking, and it was good stuff. But some people, when they get that to direct, they give you an awful lot of music over it because they don't think it works. But it did work with Charles, every single script.
And as I say, it's a rather neglected series there, but I think you were a victim of BBC politics, perhaps.
I think we were, yes, because the whoever was responsible changed the time of transmission every week, which didn't give it much of a chance. It was sad. Particularly as people kept saying what a lovely series it was.
A lot of the stuff you've done recently, Tony Grounds, it is his subject, but has been about class. A lot of the dinner party is about that. A Class Apart is about that. As I say, having the range in your background, having changed your voice and so on, that's presumably quite an interesting area for you.
Yes, because in Class Apart, I was a granddad, Cockney granddad, and in the dinner party, I was bit posh, and probably the only redeeming feature about the play was my character, because they were really, well, the two young people weren't, they were all right, but the others were monsters.
Some people in their later years get depressed, they get angry, they just simply don't like getting older. Have you felt any of that?
No. I mean, I don't like the fact that I'm not as nippy on my feet as I used to be. And I've never run anywhere anyway, so that hasn't worried me. No, you get a bit slower. bit stiff when you get up from the chairs. I will after talking to you. You'll help me out, though, won't you?
I will, yeah.
No, it doesn't worry me.
And I suggested earlier, one of the great things about acting is that you can. You can simply keep going.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm still going. I mean, the last thing I did in the theatre, I think, before Party Peace, was Heritage at Hampstead, in which I played a Chelsea pensioner. And that was a lovely play. And we went down to have lunch at the Royal Hospital. And they're terribly funny because they say, the only ones who leave here leave to get married, which is extraordinary. And they're so full of vitality, energy, and lovely people to be with.
The OBE you got, did that mean a great deal to you?
Not a great deal. It was very nice. Yeah, it's all right. I think anything like that. I probably didn't approve of it before I got it.
Well, no, I wondered about that.
Yeah, no. I do now.
And who gave it to you?
Her Majesty.
And did she say nice little Erna or anything to you when she...
No, she said, are you still doing the television work? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. She said, I don't see you very much. I'm very busy now.
You say you wouldn't have approved of it before, so you bit of a lefty, were you?
No, I just think... I don't think it's right for actors to get these awards. I think sort of people in business and inventing and people like that are the ones who really deserve them. But, I mean, we get well paid for doing something we like doing. But that was nice to have. And it was nice to go to the palace and take the family with me and have the car searched as we went in and be slightly embarrassed because there were two pots of curry that my wife had brought up in the car for our daughter. And the police wanted to know what it was.
Do you have any regrets at all about your acting career?
No, none at all. No.
Pretty happy position to be in.
Yes, very.
George Cole, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching, Minder. And goodbye from Arthur. For now.